Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm Josh Fennett.
And I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan. On today's show, we carefully unwrap a few treats from the world of packaging design.
If you can get a stranger on the other side of the world to pick up a piece of packaging off a shelf you've created and make that sale in those 5 seconds you've got, that for us is what great design's about.
We talked to the creative director of a design agency about how packaging can buoy a brand's identity.
We travelled to Australia to pay tribute to an underappreciated Antipodean design object, the fruit carton.
And visit a factory in southern China that's already preparing for the Christmas rush, on luxury tin packaging, that is. Plus,
it was really interesting to see designers working with the materials that they do have on the island. So wool, there are a lot of sheep in Iceland, and also sulphur.
Design journalist and editor of Fiera magazine, Katie Tregidden, joins us in the studio to talk through what we may have missed from this season's design fairs.
All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24.
Packaging is more than a protective layer to insulate products from harm. It's also an opportunity for brands to distinguish themselves from their competitors and stand out on the shelf.
Whether it's a subtle logo, shouty font, or the choice of paper, ply, or the opening method, the manner of wrapping up a product can offer clues to its contents. Enter John Sweeney. He's the creative director of Cult, a design agency right here in London.
I sat down with John to find out more about the thinking behind some of the packaging designs he's worked on with Cult.
For us, great design is about more than aesthetics. And we always wanted to avoid becoming designers. Designers who created things that they could show off to other designers. We wanted to run a business and create a business that was about really making a difference to a client's bottom line. And for us in design, there's arguably no other sector where you can make a bigger, more tangible difference to the bottom line than packaging. Because ultimately, once you take away the big marketing campaigns and the salesmen and the samples been handed out, what happens is you have a consumer standing at a shelf, looking at a range of products, and you've created the piece that you want them to pick up off the shelf. And if you can get a stranger on the other side of the world to pick up a piece of packaging off a shelf that you've created and make that sale in those 5 seconds you've got, that for us is what great design's about.
Now, we're going to have a look at some of the work that you've done on packaging for various products in a minute. But before we do that, I wonder if you could explain to me a little bit about the role of packaging, as you see it, in relation to other aspects of a brand's identity.
It can really vary, to be completely honest. Some brands, the packaging can be the entire brand experience. An example would be a brand called Hiver Beers, who we've worked with for the last year or two. And it was a small startup brand, and the client came to us with the concept and the product, great product. We came up with the name, creating a bespoke typographic approach. And we went down a screen printed bottle route, and we secured bottles that were ownable, but, you know, off the shelf. So we really tried to create something as bespoke as possible within a limited budget, because when the client was going out and taking this to bars to try and get them to stock it or resellers, this was all she really had to sell the brand. She didn't have the bells and whistles of a massive Heineken budget behind her. The bottle really had to do all that work.
And could you say a little bit about the product itself and why you think the design of this bottle reflects it and sells it?
The product's a honey beer based on honey sourced from in and around London. It's a real crafted product, and we wanted the bottle to communicate that. So we, as I say, we've used a screen print process on the bottle. So the bottle has a tactile hand feel, and that in itself starts to allude to the kind of the craftsmanship and the care that goes into what's in the bottle. It's not just another shiny label. And we've crafted that story that explains the background and heritage of the brand as well. At one end of the spectrum, the packaging is the entire brand experience. But you have the other end of the spectrum where, for instance, we last year carried out a project for Adidas, and that was part of a campaign launching the sponsorship of the new Man U kit. And that was really a piece of super bespoke, luxury premium packaging that was a brand within a brand within a brand. There was an established Break Expectations campaign created, and we were working within that. But again, our job was to try and create an emotional moment between the package and the consumer. So packaging, it can be the end all be all, or it can be part of a far wider marketing plan.
Now, I wonder, how do you decide what packaging forms to use for a given product? Because one thing that I find interesting about the Adidas Man U shirt that you put out, I mean, it's not necessarily the most intuitive move to put a shirt in a box. You know, you could have packed it any other way. Shirts are a very kind of malleable product, which you can enfold into various different shapes and stuff. How do you conceive of the form that packaging should take?
It is absolutely always down to the budget and the brief. With, you're absolutely right, that shirt could have been packaged in any number of ways. But the brief that we had from the client was they wanted a staggered reveal. They wanted it to be a slow process. So you were building up excitement throughout it. So we have the outer case, so the tray removes from there. That's then got a four-piece cover, so that is unhinged. And then even inside there, you have a further layer that's die-cut where you can start to see the shirt through it. And then you unveil the shirt. So there's a real layered reveal there because this should be the first time this consumer will have ever seen this shirt. So the intention was to really slow down that process and to make it as exciting as possible.
So what effect do you think good packaging should have and what can it have?
Good packaging should ultimately tell a story. It should make some sort of emotional connection with a consumer, whether it's a bottle of beer or whether it's a super premium piece of sports packaging. But for us, good packaging can really make the difference between a successful business and an unsuccessful business. We work currently with a brand called Frobishers, a fruit juice company. And when we started working with them 4 years ago, they had a perfectly good product, but with a packaging solution that felt like a premium own brand. And we worked with them to create a new look and feel, a new brand mark, a new brand platform, and apply that all across their packaging to create a completely new feel for the brand. That transformed the business. Within 2 to 3 years, turnover had more than doubled, profit had went through the roof, really allowed them to invest in NPD. And from there, we've developed further products with them, the Fusion range and the Classics range we were looking at today. And we're developing further products for them as well. And while the marketing team and the sales team, I'm sure, had a massive input in the success of that, the marketing director attributes a huge amount of that success to the design changes that were made there. And I don't think there's any greater advert for the power of design, certainly in a commercial environment, than that case study for us.
John Sweeney there, Creative Director of Branding, Packaging and Design Agency, Colt. Now, fruit may not seem like an obvious cargo for innovative packing solutions. After all, many of these fleshy orbs come complete with their own protection from the elements. But the National Library of Australia has made a quirky new addition to its collection, a catalogue of far-flung fruit cartons and ornate cardboard boxes that Australian farmers have long used to move their produce between states.
Perhaps unsurprisingly, these daily sites haven't always received too much design scrutiny. But not too long ago, a Sydney-based artist by the name of Sean Rafferty began collecting and documenting the mediums on a website called Cartonography, a zesty collection that soon caught the eye of the National Library.
Monocle's ever-inquisitive Adrian Craddock recently met with Sean to discuss the artist's fruity pastime.
I'm walking near a busy highway in suburban Sydney. It's a part of town I've never been to before, and cars are whizzing past me. The reason I'm here is because I'm trying to find the house of Sean Rafferty. He's an artist who's fascinated by a very obscure area of Australian design, the ornate cardboard boxes that farmers use to pack their produce and ship it to market. He's become so obsessed with the cartons that he's travelled around parts of the country collecting them. Why is he so curious about them? Well, for one, he sees them as overlooked forms of art. They're full of strange illustrations, bright colours, and hilarious visual jokes. He also thinks the boxes communicate something important about the farmers who design them. The cartons give insight into their personalities, their humour, and their relationship with the land. Once I finally find Sean's house, he greets me and leads me over to a corrugated iron building in his backyard. He takes out a key and unlocks the door. So can you just explain where we are right now?
So this is a shed at the back of my house, and it's essentially where I keep a large collection of fruit cartons.
How many cartons do you think there are in here?
I had an exhibition in 2014, and at that point, in late 2014, there was 325, and since then I've been steadily collecting. So I put the number around 500.
How did you begin this journey? How did you come to have all these cartons?
Well, I used to work in fruit markets. There's a fruit market in Sydney called Harris Farm Market, so I have a number of shops across Sydney, and I used to work there part-time as a student. Later on, I started doing delivery work for them, and at that point, I was handling a hell of a lot of fruit cartons and noticing the designs and the artwork on them. I started to collect the ones that I really liked at that point, and then a couple of years later, I guess formalised the process. This is a particularly nice one. This is a carton from a farm I actually visited, and it's quite close to the town of Innisfail in far north Queensland, and it's Bill Sinton is the farmer, and it simply says Sinton's Bananas, but it has a banana in a banana lounge drinking a cocktail with a straw hat, which is emblazoned with fruit and vegetables and flowers, and he's under an umbrella. So it's an amazing fruit carton. He's wearing Wayfarers, I should also add.
So when you met a lot of these farmers and then you saw the designs of their cartons, I mean, could you work out what their cartons said about them, maybe what it said about their regions, what it said about their personalities?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's a little bit difficult to make a direct connection some of the times, but I definitely think that, you know, if someone has a great sense of humour or is a bit of a character, their fruit carton is generally quite lively.
As I look around the space, I notice that there seems to be fruit cartons from all kinds of places. I start to wonder whether there are certain regions that know how to design fruit cartons better than others. When I ask Sean, he says some of his favourites come from far north Queensland, the very northern tip of East Coast Australia.
The design on fruit cartons is, I think, emblematic of the places they're from. So as you go north to far north Queensland, where there's a great concentration of fruit cartons, there are a lot more anthropomorphic fruit and vegetable characters. A lot of the time they're based on the family's name. So there's ones that here, like the Cross family from Welcome Creek in far north Queensland. They've got like a whole series of fruit cartons which are based on their name, Cross. So they've got the Grumpy Gourmet Tomatoes and Cranky Capsicums, which is like a pretty angry looking capsicum right there. There's an Italian family from Dimbula called the Bugnos, and it's spelled B-U-G-N-O, and no one can pronounce it correctly. They always get called the Bugnos, so they decided to embrace that and make their carton Bug Citrus, which has got two lady beetles holding aloft some citrus.
Is there such thing as a beautiful fruit carton?
It's an interesting question. I think that some cartons could be described as beautiful. I'm not sure I would apply that description to many.
Do you have an example that we might be able to have a look at?
Sure. Let's see. It's a carton that's been made for taro root. And if I can find it. Yeah, there it is. It's only two colours, white and black. So the cardboard generally is white and then they print colour onto it. In this case, they've only chosen to print black. And it has a sort of half-tone taro root that's across the carton surface in six places, and then a large X that sort of sways through the six taro root. And it's from X Farms, and that's why there's a big X there. But it has this kind of like 70s conceptual art kind of ephemera feel to it. And the
it looks like something that could almost be kind of a band poster or something like that.
Yeah, I think it just has this kind of zeitgeisty feel to it. And yeah, I think I like it so much because it is just quite uncharacteristic.
As striking as the taro root carton is, I can't help wondering why the farmers went to so much trouble. Fruit cartons are only traded between wholesalers and other businesses. In that context, what would be the harm in shipping produce in a plain white box? I put this question to Sean.
They do want to stand out at market. I've talked to a few farmers, and they want their carton to have an impact at market. There's a sort of why not attitude, you know, why not make it kind of impactful or colourful or humorous.
So when you're out and about, I mean, do you always find yourself kind of, you're looking for cartons out the corner of your eye when you're kind of just in the city?
Yeah, definitely. I think that It's one of those things where they spring up everywhere. When I'm out and about, I'm always looking in rubbish bins and behind restaurants and underneath fruit and vegetable stacks in grocers and stuff like that. So I'm a borderline dumpster diver and sometimes have to be in awkward situations in order to acquire a carton.
How does your wife feel about this big collection out here? I mean, was it always this ordered? Was it always kind of this neat?
No, it's kind of a recent storage solution. It hasn't really imposed on our relationship yet, but the time is coming, I'm sure.
Sydney-based artist Sean Rafferty there, speaking to Monocle's Melbourne correspondent Adrian Craddock.
And for a moment, we pack up the packaging talk and speak about this year's design trade shows so far.
Katie Tregidden is a design journalist and the editor of Fiera magazine, a biannual dedicated to discovering and documenting new talent and trends in an industry that often forgets about fairs as soon as they pass.
Katie joined us in studio for a roundup of what we may have missed.
We cover IMM Cologne, Maison et Objet in Paris and Milan Design Week, which I guess are all fairly obvious choices. The wild card, if you like, is Design March in Reykjavik, which has been going for about 4 years and was really interesting to see the sort of things that are coming out of Iceland being quite a sort of isolated island nation.
So let's move through this chronologically so people can have a bit of a digest of all of the collected experiences, the designers that you've seen. So you start off in IMM Cologne. It's quite a foreboding affair. I've been once or twice, and it's an enormous Kölnmesse, kind of marble-floored, high-ceilinged, bit of a mess of a place. It's the kind of thing that in the 80s someone obviously thought would serve the city well to have this amazing, faceless kind of meeting place. But there is so much room, there's so much to see. How did you go about tackling it, and what have you filleted for us to delight in?
I'm incredibly strategic when I do shows of that size. I'm only really interested in young, upcoming designers, so I don't spend a lot of time in the massive, great big halls with massive, great big brands launching this season's sofa in a slightly different colour from last season's sofa. I actually head straight to the Pure Talents contest, which is curated by the show, and that's all up-and-coming designers from all over the world and their products. This year, they also had lots of university stands as well, so around the edges of some of the big halls, there were offerings from various international universities, and there were lots of really interesting graduate projects at those as well, and some sort of curated spaces. So there was something called Istanbul Dan, which was a bunch of German designers who went to Istanbul to work with local craftsmen and were showing their products sort of before and after that experience.
So not just the low-hanging fruit from the biggest brands. I wonder if you can give us the pick of the punnet. Who were the most interesting designers that you saw?
Louisa Karlfeldt had a really interesting project, which was a stool made from, if you imagine corrugated cardboard, and it's sort of wound in a spiral until it creates something stool-shaped, and she's then shaved off the edges to round the top of the stool, but also reveal the colour patterns between the different layers of cardboard. It's a sustainable product. It was a project she did at university, and the brief was make a stool out of cardboard. So there's the sustainability angle, and obviously also how you make something strong enough from a relatively bendy material. But she's finished it in such a way that it's turned into a really beautiful piece, and something that doesn't have that sort of, it doesn't necessarily scream sustainability. It's a beautiful object first, and something that's environmentally friendly second.
So from the top spot at this Teutonic trade show, we move to Paris, Maison et Objet, probably my favourite as someone that does a lot of the still lifes for Monocle magazine. There are a lot of colourful, small, crafty, Central European kind of offerings here, people who've jacked in their jobs to start making beautifully decorated soap, as well as some of, you know, Vitra's new launches and, you know, everything from Artek and the bigger companies. What was your overall impression of Maison et Objet this year?
I think Maison was really interesting this year. It came relatively shortly after the terror attacks in Paris, which were November, the show's in January. Attendance levels were down by 40%, 40. So that's almost half as many people as would normally go, which was really sad, actually, to see all those people who'd invested in stands and, you know, and in their products to show to the world, but absolutely understandable. So it was really heartening to see the people who were there sort of doing really well and chatting to them and being there to sort of support them and to show up and that sort of thing. As you mentioned, there's a lot of really interesting work. The UKTI actually have a big space there. So funnily enough, there's a lot of British designers there, which is always lovely when you're away from home to bump into some friendly faces. But yeah, a lot of what I would call sort of one-man bands, so young independent designers, often designing and making their own products or otherwise working in sort of small batch manufacture.
It's an overwhelmingly interesting trade show and a bit of a staple here at Monocle. We will have a report from the September edition. One place that isn't really a staple of our design coverage, not for lack of its craft heritage, is Reykjavik Design March. Now, was this just an excuse for you to go and jump in and out of a few thermal baths?
Obviously. It was really interesting, actually. It was a show I hadn't been to before, and I was slightly nervous about whether I was going to get enough content, because there isn't a big sort of main exhibition of stuff in the same way that there is in a lot of design weeks. But what there was a one-day conference, and my heart sank when I saw that on the agenda, but it was absolutely brilliant. Usually you go to these things and there's sort of one standout speaker, maybe two, but pretty much every speaker was fascinating, and I actually got an awful lot of content from that side of things. So a lot of the opinion pieces in the magazine have come from that conference. And there was also a lot of really interesting work. So Iceland is a volcanic island, so it doesn't have wood, doesn't have very many trees. And it's also a long way from anywhere, so it's very difficult for them to import and export product. So it was really interesting to see designers working with the materials that they do have on the island. So wool, there are a lot of sheep in Iceland, and also sulfur. So there's a guy who's making products from solidified sulfur, which is such a common sort of element in the heating systems and the geothermal pools, but actually to turn that into product and make something that's so familiar to the Icelandic people into something tangible, I thought was a really interesting project.
Penultimate question is probably the hardest I'll ask you. You know, how do you sum up the grand behemoth of trade shows that is Salone del Mobile every April, the biggest design event on the calendar, certainly for the European market, but also because the European market is a meeting point in some ways for the American and Asian market. A tremendous barometer for what's going on in the industry. What were your readings?
I think it was really interesting this year, actually. In Milan, people tend to go for scale. It tends to be sort of big and impressive and, you know, the big brands win. This year, there were a lot more people being quite innovative in the ways in which they got people's attention. And there's actually a piece in the magazine about design as a performance, which touches on this. So Lee Broom, who last year had a sort of entire department store to show his products.
He took to the road this year, didn't he?
He took to the road. So he had Salon del Automobile, which was basically his showroom in the back of a lorry.
A weak pun, do you think?
Yeah, but a genius idea, because everywhere you went, there was Lee Broom. And I thought that was really interesting, really clever, a really sort of disruptive way to get into Milan Design Week. And obviously, it being Lee Broom, stunningly executed right down to the girls' overalls who were manning the stand, in inverted commas. Airbnb's sort of installation was interesting as well. They took
That's right,
over.
We ran into one another there over breakfast.
Yes, we did. But I thought that was really interesting because they took over a restaurant and served breakfast for the duration of Milan Design Week, giving people an opportunity to sort of put their feet up. But interestingly, rather than products on plinths, which is usually what happens at design fairs, you were able to drink from and eat from and pour from the products that they were showing. So they'd commissioned various new designers to make things which visitors were actually able to use.
Design journalist and editor of Fiera magazine, Katie Tregidden there. Issue 4 of Fiera is available now from fieramagazine.com.
Next up on the show, we open the lid on production of an altogether less discussed manner of packaging, the humble tin box.
Quaint and robust in equal measure, tin boxes have maintained their appeal, and although it may be July, it's the middle of the rush to get them made for Christmas. To find out more about how they're made and the kind of companies that are ordering them, we sent Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief James Chambers to the factory of Jeff, a Hong Kong-based company that makes packaging for the likes of Harrods, Lindt and Faber-Castell. Here's what he found.
If you've ever received a set of pencils or selection of chocolates in a handsome tin box, you'll appreciate the feeling of luxury such sturdy packaging lends to a product over plastic and cardboard. To find out how these tins are made and what you can learn about the luxury market from their production, I've come to the factory of Jeff, a company that specializes in making tin boxes for luxury clients in Western Europe. Jacques Robert Joubert is a member of the French family who run the Hong Kong headquartered company, and he showed me around Jeff's central production and product showroom in Shenzhen, which is in mainland China, about an hour's drive from the Hong Kong border.
Most of our main customers, they all, one point or the other, did come over here. For something like tin boxes, since it's such a long production time and you really need to be able to trust your supplier, so we do ask them to come and visit us, and we're very happy to always have them here. And I think our clients really appreciate coming down here and seeing how everything is being run. Some of them are really interested in how it all works, because often when you receive the tin box, you don't understand the whole process that's behind it. So right now we're inside the trim room. So we received the printed tin sheets in this room, and then we'll proceed to cut them down to the individual tin boxes. For example, on this tin sheet for some tea, so we have all the lids on one side, the bottoms, and all the bodies in the middle. So right now on this tin sheet you have 14 bodies and probably also 14 lids and 14 bottoms. We then need around 2-3 weeks for finishing the production. So the cutting part is going very fast. And now we even started adding some automatic machines in order to automate the lid production in order to save time.
So besides food producers and confectioners and the department stores, are there any other luxury brands or businesses that are coming to you for your tin boxes?
So we do have a number of them. So first of all, stationery has always been a popular item for putting your products in tin boxes. We're seeing a lot of cosmetic companies also promoting their brands and their image with gift packs inside of a tin box. Another industry that we have is the home decoration. So these boxes will be sold empty, and it's really all about the design and the artwork that will catch the eye of people, and they'll buy it and to put in their house for storing the different items.
On a blazingly hot summer's day, over 200 employees are busily working away inside a four-story factory building. Somewhat incongruously, they're putting the finishing touches to chocolate boxes and sweet tins decorated with reindeers and snowy landscapes. It's the Christmas order rush season, and come December, these boxes will be filling the shelves of the food hall in Harrods and other high-end department stores in London, Paris, and Frankfurt.
What does the design process for these tin boxes look like?
So we received the briefs probably 1 year before they want the products in their stores. So from the briefs, we will look into the existing molds that we have and how we can connect the dots between what they're looking at and what we have. If there's really nothing inside that they want, then we can always open a new mold for them. But often the case is we do have existing molds, and if it's a few millimeters difference, then the client will be able to accept it. Then after, once the shape has been selected, we need them to provide us with the artworks and any embossing needs and any extra features.
Are there any boxes in the showroom that are a particular favorite of yours?
So it's a hard question. We do have a lot of tin boxes coming in, and a lot of them are really pretty. Maybe one I like is this biscuit assortment. So it's a square box with very sharp corners, and we've done this for Harrods in the past. The work on the embossing, on the reflex colors, and on the whole artwork is really nice because it gives a real antique look. So it looks like you're buying a box from the 40s or 30s or whatnot. And this is one of my particular favorites. Other boxes that we do that are very interesting is we do a lot of these musical carousels. So inside we add a whole spinning musical equipment. And so once you place it on the table, the round box will be like a carousel and spin on itself.
That was Monocle's Hong Kong Bureau Chief James Chambers reporting from the factory of Jeff Tin Boxes in Shenzhen, southern China. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Alex Funnell, and the show's producer, sat right opposite me, Henry Rhys Sheridan.
If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to drop me a line at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next week at the same time. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud and iTunes. And please leave us a review on the latter.
You've been listening to Section D. I'm Josh Fennett.
And I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. Until next time, it's goodbye from us.